We are now recording.
Excellent. Welcome, everybody, to the Board of Technical Registration meeting. Kurt, can I have a roll call, please?
Dr. Alejandro Angel. Jack Gilmore.
Here.
Neil Jones.
Here.
Clarence McAllister. Carmen Wyckoff.
Here.
Stephen Knoll.
Here.
Andrew Everode.
Here.
Helmut Hack.
Here.
We have a quorum.
So I'd like to take a moment to welcome Mr. Hack. I appreciate you volunteering for our board, and we look forward to collaborating with you. So welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Excellent. I understand we might have two calls for the public. Kurt, I'll remind them that it should be for no more than 3 minutes, and we would love to hear what they have to say. So who is our first call to the public?
Let's see. Is Mr. Lipley on the line? All right, so I'll find the combo. Let's see, is Mr. Nadla on the line? I don't hear either, but let me call Mr. Lepley. I think Dr. Angel just joined us now.
Excellent. Welcome, Dr. Angel.
Okay, one moment. Yeah, I'm going to call Mr. Lipley. Okay. This is Kurt Winter.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. This is Kurt Winter, the AZVTR. Is this Mr. Lipley?
Yes.
We're here at the board meeting, at the call to the public. Would you like to speak with the board?
Yes. Hello, board. Thank you for your time and opportunity to speak with you. I would like to, I've contacted AZVTR. I'm a licensed architect in Bisbee, Arizona. And I noticed that I've been having trouble potentially with some religious clients, and I noticed that my license number is 66651. You know, I'm somewhat religious, and I just would like to throw it out there that there is no current way of changing a license number that might have a religious stigma attached with it without technically losing your license. And I would like the board to consider an alternative way for somebody to simply change one digit or apply to change one digit or change their number entirely to avoid such stigmas that may impact that license holder's business with the Catholic Church or other religious entities. I noticed for a certain time period in 2018 when I got my license, because of how the license numbers are given out, that the numbers are serialized. So there are about 200 people with a similar number. And they might also share similar feelings. I realize in the scope of things it might seem quite trivial, but if architects and engineers work on big projects and might only work on one project in a year, so if we lose a project like that, it's kind of a big deal for us. So, you know, I just want the board to consider that. I know it might seem trivial, but you know, if you're on the other end of it, it might not seem. So that's all. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for calling in. I know it's not on the agenda, so that we can't address it today. But
correct.
That is an odd predicament you're in, and we'll I'll work with staff, and we'll see if there's anything we can do about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Kurt, do you want to double check that our other call to the public's not on the line?
Okay. Mr. Nadlal, are you on the line?
Oh, this is Martin Kuhn speaking.
Mr. Kuhn, we're not to your agenda item quite yet.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
He didn't indicate to call him or anything, and he was kind of wishy-washy if he was going to be here or not, so I think we can proceed.
Excellent. Thank you. Next up, then, we have adoption of minutes. After reviewing the minutes, do I have a motion to adopt? Let's go with the board meeting on March 23rd. Was everybody here for both the board meeting and the executive? Can we consent them all at once? Do I hear a motion for that?
Chair, I'll make a motion.
So moved.
Accept the minutes for the March 23rd in the executive session.
Thank you. I have a motion. I heard a second from the phone.
That was me, Alejandro Angel.
Thank you, Dr.
Morning,
Angel.
Carmen.
Who?
Oh, we miss you, Dr. Angel.
Okay. Yeah, I'm still here.
Are we ready for any discussion? Hearing none, and if you weren't here, please abstain from voting on the minutes.
Okay.
Excellent. Kurt, a roll call, please.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Aye.
Jack Gilmore.
Aye.
Neil Jones.
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Aye.
Stephen Knoll.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Helmut Hack.
Aye.
Be abstained.
Roll call.
Yep. So, because when we vote on minutes, this is for
the
minutes.
Oh,
that
was the vote. Okay.
So, if you're not here at that meeting, you try to abstain. Cool. Thanks. Excellent. Unanimous passing with one abstention. Okay. Next up, moving right along, FA1. I heard Mr. Kuhn was on the line. Everybody in your board packet. Mr.
Kuhn
did also.
Yes. Wait, it's at
9:30
is the hearings.
Oh, good point. Thank you, Kurt. Sorry, Mr. Kuhn, we're going to have to wait till 9:30 because of how things are agendized. Perhaps then, would suggest maybe we skip to 6A2 since Mr. Oxford is here in person.
Yes.
Excellent. No objection. I'll suggest we go to 682, please.
And you can come to the table if you wish, sir.
Can I take my muffle off for a speak?
Sure.
So which one? Travis said that I am fully vaccinated.
And Mr. Kramer, do you want to come up as well? Thank you. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So the gist of this one is that we've got a report about a solar array that was stamped when an architect was in a delinquent status. And the EAC found was recommending to dismiss because it was ancillary to kind of the overall work. And if you don't mind stating your name and then telling us in about 3 to 5 minutes kind of your side of what's going on here.
Yes. My name is Clint Augsburger. I'm a registered mechanical engineer since 1975. I'm, first of all, good morning, board members and staff members of the BTR. I want to provide additional information in support of my complaint against Harvey Bryan, whose architectural license 34448 had expired over 3 years ago in March 2018. Therefore, at the time he prepared his reports on 8/18/2020 and 9/14/2020, he was in violation of ARS 32-127D. The registrant shall not practice, offer to practice, or advertise if the certificate of registration is inactive or invalid. My background, I was registered in mechanical engineering in 1975, and I'm still practicing. From 75 to the present, I have designed and installed a variety of solar energy devices and systems. I was the first Arizona engineer to design carports with solar collectors as a structural roofing component. From 1984 to 87, I was the governor appointee to the Arizona Solar Energy Commission. Starting in 1984, I spent 8 years as a mechanical member of the Arizona BTR's Enforcement Advisory Committee. The project, on July 15, 2020, I applied to the ARC Committee, the Architectural Review Committee of Troon Village Association, to install a 115-square-foot photovoltaic system that I designed myself. Under ARS 44-1762, solar energy devices, warranties, installation standards, and inspections, F, solar energy devices that are designed and installed by the final owner are exempt from the requirements of subsection A through E of this section. By exempting sections A through E, there are no performance requirements for the solar energy device designed and installed by the final owner. The solar array would also provide shade for the utility area on the southeast side of my home. TVA ARC refused my application and hired Harvey Bryant to support the refusal. On August 18, 2020, I was provided with an undated, unsigned, and unsealed copy of Harvey Bryant's report. This report was his response to providing an assessment of my proposed design and to address the efficacy of my system and to provide alternative areas for placement to show that it was not an optimum location for the PV array. My purpose in choosing the location was to provide shade and a moderate amount of PV power. Of course, there are other locations on my roof that would be more solar efficient, but I did not want a PV system on my tile roof, and I wanted the shade component as well. In his first report, Harvey Bryant mentions that he is professionally registered in several states, which prompted me to see if Arizona was one of the states, and I found that his registration had lapsed in Arizona. On or about August 21st, 2020, in a phone call to BTR's enforcement manager, Doug Parlin, relating to Harvey Bryant's work, Doug Parlin related to me that the registrant chose not to renew registration and therefore cannot perform professional work in Arizona until he renews. By describing his other registration, he was advertising he was qualified as an architect to render his assessment. According to his invoice dated 7-2020 for the solar assessment work, he had provided modeling of alternative placement, which certainly would require the use of his skills that he had learned and practiced as an architect. On or about September 25th, 2020, I received a response from Harvey Bryant, PhD, signed and dated September 14th, 2020. In the first paragraph, Harvey Bryant describes, "Mr. Augsburger should know that the solar assessment report I provided to you was not a design document, nor did I perform any design services. Thus, it did not need to be certified by a licensed design professional." He further states, "2 years ago, I relinquished my design practice to focus on my consultancy," I'll repeat, consultancy, "and chose to give up a number of my licenses. However, I still keep active my original California license, which I've had for 42 years. My Arizona license expired in March 2018, actually March 31st of 2018, but according to AZBTR, it can be reinstated at any time, but I do not believe I need to do this in this case. My complaint against Harvey Bryant was the result of my submission of a PV solar shade design for the southeast corner of my home in Troon Village. As often happens, the ARC does not like to deal with designs that are doing different. So they sought help through their legal counsel, Krupnik and Spies, to come up with reasons why my design was not a good one. And they hired Harvey Bryant for the task. Bryant wrote 2 unsealed reports that provided reasons that my design was not optimum. I knew that from the start that I did not want anything on my tile roof, especially a PV solar array. ARS 44-1762 encourages innovation by not requiring performance standards for solar energy devices that are designed and installed by the final owner, which was my goal. There is no question that Harvey Bryant is a qualified architect. He has many degrees and is a full professor of architecture at ASU and an AIA fellow. The problem is that he did not renew his Arizona registration. And since he currently classifies his business as a consultancy, he states that professional registration is not required, although he is providing services to the public. ARS 32-127 a registrant shall not practice, offer to practice, or advertise if the certificate of registration is inactive or invalid. Question number one, was Harvey Bryan providing for the health, safety, and welfare of the public? ARS 32-101, the purpose of this chapter is to provide for the safety, health, and welfare of the public through the promulgation and enforcement of standards.
Sir, we're way beyond 5 minutes. Can you maybe summarize the questions you want to ask?
Yeah, I just have a half a page left.
Okay,
here.
Thank you.
Thanks. The purpose of this chapter is to provide for the safety, health, and welfare of the public through the promulgation and enforcement of standards and qualifications for those individuals who are registered or certified and seeking registration or certification pursuant to this chapter. Harvey Bryan certainly did not have my welfare in mind. Was Harvey Bryan practicing architecture? 32-101B7, architectural practice, means any professional service or creative work requiring architectural education, training, and experience, and the application of the mathematical and physical sciences and the principles of architecture and architectural engineering to such professional services or creative work as consultation, evaluation, design, and review of construction for conformance with contract documents and design in connection with any building, planning, or site development. A person shall be deemed to practice or offer to practice architecture who in any manner represents that the person is an architect or is able to perform any architectural service or other services recognized by educational authorities as architecture. Harvey Bryan wrote the two reports utilizing knowledge he gained through his education and practice as an architect. Knowledge that he had used to become registered as an architect in Arizona and other states. He was able to write these reports because he is an architect. Arizona statutes require that he offers this service to the public, he must be registered. Harvey Bryan is clearly in violation of ARS 32-101A and ARS 32-127D, and I'm requesting that at a minimum, the board order him to recall his subject reports and refund to Troon Village Association the $1,312.50 that he charged for the reports. Additionally, he is in violation of ARS 32-145 violations, which is a class 2 misdemeanor. Arrest.
Thank you. I appreciate the explanation. Mr. Kramer, can you please give us a little background from what your investigation or the EAC discovered?
Yes, first there was no EAC, as the two assessors that were called upon to review this both decided or reported that an EAC was not necessary. One said that Mr. Bryan was performing his services as a PhD and professor, not as an architect. And the other one said that Mr. Bryan was providing consulting services and not design services. So neither one felt that an EAC was necessary. They basically unsubstantiated the allegation. And Matt, I correct Mr. Osberger that his registration is delinquent, is not, at the time, was not expired. It is now. But at the time, he was just delinquent.
Okay. So, board members, do you have any questions about this case? Yes?
One question. You just mentioned that one of the reviewers that you talked to said because you had a PhD, it was okay. Did the other reviewer had the opposite opinion in terms of your position?
No.
Were they both the same position?
No, Mr. Bryan relied on his expertise as a professor and a PhD working at Arizona State University, and they both assessors felt the same.
Other board members? Any concerns about this? I completely understand why you might want shade trellis and totally using PV to make shade makes sense to me, but I don't see, looking through the packet, where there'd be a violation here, unfortunately. So, unfortunately for you. I think the fact that he has a PhD in solar panels seems like his highest qualification to me. Anybody else? Yes.
Well, I guess the question is, having a PhD, does that mean you don't have to be registered or currently registered?
So what did you just say?
That's a good question, but sorry, this is Alejandro Angel. Where I see the difference is, as I reviewed the solar assessment that he did, I don't see practice of architecture. I mean, the main points he makes are about the orientation of the system, the shade,
the efficiency based on that. So I, you know, if he had stamped a set of plans or provided a, you know, architectural review comment letter, that seems like it would have been different to me. I'm not seeing it on this report.
So I do see, yeah, you're right, Dr. Angel. Yes? Are we still in?
We're okay. We have Andy and Alejandro.
Okay.
Okay.
Just double check.
For the record, Mr. Holmert stepped out for just a moment. Thanks. So any other questions about this case?
Wait,
yes?
To follow up on Dr. Alarin, a good professor. I don't quite see it that way in the sense that he gave an opinion on the solar panels and was talking about maybe the best place to put it. I mean, isn't there, and if you're talking about the roof, isn't there architectural thought to that? Or I mean, I'm not sure what. That he's not practicing some sort of regulated position here.
So my thoughts were that he was more giving his opinion on the orientation of the panels and how much solar energy they would produce, which seems within his PhD on renewable energies. You see it a different way?
Well, I guess I don't quite understand the rules of solar panels and mechanical engineering. If it seems like a mechanical engineering question. If he's talking about how efficient it is or not efficient,
mm-hmm.
I mean, actually, I don't think that should matter at all, really. If he wants to put it in for shade and, oh, by the way, I'll put some panels on top, so be it.
It comes down to, Dr. Angel?
I'm sorry. Yes, I think you made several good points, which is the question of where he wants to put him is really a question between him and the HOA. I don't think that our respondent here was saying that he could or couldn't. I think he just provided an opinion on the efficiency of the system. I don't know. I would read the what our rules say about what's the practice of architecture, and I don't know that opining on, you know, the orientation of a solar system. If he was talking about, you know, what kind of inverter to use and what kind of mounts to use, that would definitely be either architecture or engineering, but I don't think the orientation is, you know, protected practice. Just my thoughts.
I understand.
So do I hear a motion, Dr. Angel?
Sure, I would move that we dismiss complaint 6A2.
I second.
Thank you. I hear a second. Any further discussion from the board? Hearing none, Kurt, a roll call, please.
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Knoll?
Aye.
Andrew Everoad?
Aye.
Helmut Hack?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in, and I'm sorry that we couldn't help you in this case.
Thank you.
Okay, we're at 924. Kurt, may I suggest maybe 6A1? It is up for dismissal, but we have, I believe, the respondent's attorney and the respondent calling in.
Okay, is Mr. Packard and Mr. Rogers on the line? And if you're on your phone, star 6 to unmute yourself. If on the computer, there's a microphone on mute.
Yeah, this is Dwight Packard. I'm here on the phone.
Okay. Hello, Mr. Packard. Is Mr. Rogers there?
I believe that he's dialing in.
Yes, I am present.
Okay. They're both present.
Thank you for joining us. Sir, both sirs. Your case is up, recommended for dismissal. Is there any brief introduction that you want to say to the board, or are you here just for questions?
We're here primarily for questions. We believe the record that we established in the investigation that hopefully the board has at least a summary of is justification for the dismissal.
Thank you for calling in. I appreciate your time. With our callers on the line, board members, are there any questions for them?
Madam Chair, I do have a few questions, if it's okay. This is Alejandro Angel.
Dr. Angel, take it away.
So I think I followed the case, and I read the respondent's response that what they were producing was a set of record drawings. My question is about when I look at the record drawings, and for instance, I'm looking at sheets 163 or 164 in our packet. Those are sheets from the tavern and at Sky Harbor. And what worries me is, and I don't know if these are the final sheets, but I see no seal identifying who the engineer is. And I recognize that, you know, the respondent, you know, is producing record drawings based on drawings that somebody else did. That's fine. But who is the responsible registrant for this then if there is no seal? Usually the process would be whoever originated the drawings would keep the seal there. And then someone at Schaefer would have stamped for the record drawings for any changes during construction. And I don't see either in there. And I do know we have a rule that every document needs to be signed and sealed, technical document. So is there anything I'm missing?
Dr. Angel, you bring up a great question. I know in my past when a contractor does the as-built, we actually make them take off our seals because now it's their, like, markups that the sewer line went over here in the as-built.
Take off your seal?
Yeah, because it's not our final product. It's their product. Hmm.
Well, they're redlining. They're showing where the sewer's going instead of this way, it's going that way. And they provide us, the design professional, the as-built, and then we change those into
the record. So we don't change them in the end before they hand the red lines to the owner.
It's stamped with an as-built. It says as-built, but it's not sealed by anybody at that point because it's not being used to construct anything. It's a record copy. Well, and the client wasn't paying you as a record. Right. So if you don't have that service, then the contractor's got to give up. Yes. Okay, here you go. So we asked the contractor actually to remove our seal because we don't want our seal to be associated with your hand drawing, right? Yeah. So is that a similar case here? Or am I secretly, should I be very quiet about this? I'm just curious since we have all these brains around the table.
What do you think, Alejandro?
Well, so my practice is slightly different because it's been in public works in that, but I think, and Melissa, maybe you can chime in. We used to have some substantive policies at the board that dealt with how to prepare record drawings. I don't think they're on the website anymore, but
they should be.
I do know that 32.152, which is the definition of record document, says if a person or firm that is registered by the board is required to provide record drawings for improvements and the plan show changes during construction, then the following applies. And then it talks about, you know, what you need to do, and it, I think, you're supposed to seal those changes if you are a registrant and you're changing somebody else's document. So the way I've always done it is, you know, if I designed it, we seal for design, and then whoever does the as-built seals for the construction changes, or if it's vice versa.
Dr. Angel, what if it's not a registrant that does the as-built? It's like a mechanical sub.
Well, that I've never seen a non-registrant prepare record drawings because isn't the purpose of record drawings to have
a registrant?
You know, a record of what's out there and who's certifying that what got built is complies with standards and code and everything else.
Interesting. In my experience, has been with like irrigation systems on big projects and landscape subs or the irrigation contractor will do that, but they don't stamp it. So that's, it's an as-built.
More for an owner's
reference.
Well,
it's an as-built.
Yeah.
And a stamped as-built.
my stamp is still on there with my original date, but the as-built stamped afterwards with changes. So it's a...
Melissa?
All, it differently.
Hi, Alejandro.
Why did we remove our substantive policy from the website?
You know, I don't recall if maybe we rescinded it. What's on the website is what we currently have published as substantive policy statements. And I know we did go through the list a few years back, and there were several that we took off because rules had been revised, and members felt that certain substantive policy statements weren't necessary any longer. But I'm not sure if one of those that we removed is the one that you're talking about.
Because I have all of them here, even if they were removed at some point.
Oh, you do? Okay.
It would just say below that it was rescinded.
Rescinded?
Is any of these, I don't know if you can see it, Alejandro. This is our website, and these are the 19 substantive policies that were put out there.
I'm not seeing it right now, Kurt, but I guess that's an important question, but maybe the bigger question is...
Maybe number four?
Under our rules, I think any document prepared by a registrant that's a technical document should be sealed. So if an unregistrant did it, the as-built, we could have a discussion as to whether that's appropriate or not. But if a registrant does record documents, record drawings, I think our rule says it should be sealed.
Yeah, I agree. I think number four is what you're referring to. I don't know that it applies directly here.
Is that number four?
Yeah.
This
Kurt
is,
had clicked on it. Sealing of standard details.
Let's look at it.
I think that details...
So that's kind of the...
That's not record.
Not record drawings,
details,
though.
No.
So we may not have had...
This is number seven.
Can the surveyor make a comment?
Of course.
Any board member
on engineering stuff?
Question or make a comment?
You know, I know when I do as-builts, usually the engineer's stamp is still on it, but we're also dealing with a city, and the city wants that
document.
Right,
it's
used.
A public works project at that point, right.
But what I see here is the TLCP structural is actually taking all liability for those documents, and I would say that is just fine.
I don't know, is there a professional distinction between public works and a private project?
No.
Not that I know of, but except that public works may have requirements for a stamped and sealed as built, while, you know, Neil's house, he may not care.
Because we don't know. I mean, the private client doesn't even know about this stuff.
Right.
The other thing, usually when people don't like their stuff taken off, like title bar, you know, for company, usually it has to do with copyright.
True.
The company's concerned about their copyright.
So
it's kind of hard to say what was going on between the two outfits.
Yeah, the funny thing is this sheet say that the document is the product and exclusive property of Schaefer, and then in the same sheet it says is the property of Bart Napkin. And I know that's decided by the contract elsewhere, but my concern is what if something happens to this project or something happens here later? We don't even know who the engineer of record is. It just says, you know, notes from the original engineer of record. We don't know who that is. And we don't know what was changed in construction because there's no clouding to see what was changed from the original plans. So we don't know what's Schaefer and what's the original engineer and who would be responsible for what.
So not enough information to continue?
Can I ask the respondent on the line, were there many changes to this? If you didn't cloud things, how did you document this?
Yeah, this is Robert Rogers. The project was a small tenant fit out. So the architect asked us as Schaefer, because we had done some of the design for certain little pieces, they asked us to combine, because the owner wanted a final record set of drawings. So the architect that was actually in charge of this project, who's our client, asked us to basically pull together a record set and then provide that to the architect for their use. With regard to changes on the drawings, I don't think those were identified because obviously it's a record set, so it's here's the final condition as we understand it. And to your point about field validation or verification of any and everything, you know, being at least somewhat familiar with different states, there is a real hesitancy to seal anything because you're basically trying, you're saying you're validating the as-installed condition for everything out there. You know, the engineer of record for the actual construction documents is on file, obviously, with the city when it was submitted for permit. And anything that's substantive that was changed after that point, I would have thought would have went back through the authority having jurisdiction.
So I think to that last point taking liability for stuff that's done during construction if you didn't observe it directly, our statutes do clarify that if you did not provide construction services, you can state that on the as-built or on the record drawing and say that this was based on information provided by others, which you actually did on their note. So I think that part is perfectly appropriate. What I don't think it's appropriate is, again, we don't know what was the original design and what was changed by you or others from the original design and who's certifying those things.
I don't think there's anybody to speak these things, right?
Well, when you say certifying those things, I'm confused as to what you're referring to. The prime design professional here was Barnathan's Productions, who filed the permit for construction, obviously recorded and provided those drawings to the permitting authority. No changes after that were substantive in nature that led to an engineering change for the project. So I'm slightly confused about what you mean by certifying.
I thought at one point you guys made some changes to the joists or something, if I recall seeing a detail for that. So say that a structural element of the project failed at some point. How would someone know whether that was something that was designed by Schaefer or by the original engineer?
Everything that we designed or were the engineer of record for was sealed as part of the construction issuance. Anything that TLCP did was sealed. So there are records of who did what with their seal. Obviously, if you release a design, you have to have your seal on it.
Yeah, but then this is not a record set drawings, right? I mean, the idea of the record drawings is that you can refer to the record drawings to see what was built and who's responsible for what.
Well, the record drawings were put together for the convenience of the owner. The owner requested, though, you know, there's lots of contracts where owners don't even request record drawings.
It's far more like a reference set. It sounds like.
Correct.
I still see this as an issue of either appropriating somebody else's drawings, or if they are your drawings, then you should seal them. R-43304, which talks about the use of seals, says that you need to seal each sheet of drawings or maps, and says then also says either the cover, index, or first sheet of each addenda, change order to plans, contract documents. So I don't see any exception for not sealing this type of drawings anywhere.
Does that revised code that you're referring to part of the public works?
No, this is a registrant. This is for everybody. A registrant shall place a permanently legible imprint of the registrant seal and signature on the following: each sheet of drawings or maps, and any technical document. So anything that requires engineering. or architecture you should be doing that on.
Yes, which was done.
Right.
So, TLC.
But not on the record drawings. The record drawings are plans and they don't have any seals on it from anybody.
That's correct. And typically, as I think the lady referenced earlier, typically, it's at least been my experience that you don't seal record sets of drawings because of contractor markups. Now, there could be no substantive engineering changes on those documents, but dimensions may be different. You know, whatever the contractor's marked up that was approved through RFI or change order gets incorporated.
But there are no such markups here, right? Because those are usually identified and clouded.
Yeah, what the final set was that was provided to the client by the prime design professional, the architect, we're the sub-consultant here, so we don't know exactly what the final document, but I know we did not seal any record drawings, nor do we typically as a firm.
Do other board members have questions about this subject, or can you weigh in on kind of how your office handles what your thoughts might be?
I guess I have a question. Why wouldn't they go back to TLCP to do the as-built?
Exactly.
Because that's where the stamp is.
Yeah.
That would be ideal.
That's the only thing I know. It's the original registrant does the record drawings. I have never heard of anything different. So this is very odd to me.
Respondent, can you give us just a 30 or and our investigators here? How about you weigh in?
Hi, Orlene.
Hello. Hey.
Thank you for sitting so patiently.
Yeah. So this was a complaint opened by the board based on a complaint with TLCP and Bar Napkins, which was the original. So TLC was not paid for their work, so they didn't do any of the work. So the architect hired Schaefer to complete whatever needed to be completed. And that's why we're here today. The board opened this complaint because I had the same question: is it okay for them not to seal anything and just move forward like they did with the record drawings? So we had an EAC. The EAC said that they put a disclaimer on the record set of drawings that indicated that it was prepared by others, and then they agreed that it would have been good practice to get with TLCP, the original engineer, but that there's no violations. It would have been good practice. That's all they kept saying.
Makes sense.
As usual, by the time a case gets here, there's a lot of forks in the road, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I'd be curious what Andy's response is to this, if this were to get pushed into a problem.
Mr. Everett, do you have any concerns or thoughts about this?
Here's my card. What was that,
Dan? I didn't say it, Stephen did.
Carmen, I'm not sure if I have anything else to add beyond what some of the things Dr. Angel was saying.
So, barring
this... Sure, can I make a suggestion?
Sure, Dr. Angel.
Or a request, and maybe board staff can weigh in, but it seems like this is something that we need to have a discussion on as a board, and either come up with a substantive policy or rule change or understand what we expect out of our registrants, because I don't think it's fair to anybody not to have the rules be clear. So
I agree wholeheartedly, Dr. Angel. Is that do we need a motion I guess in that case, perhaps it would be a motion to dismiss, but instructions to staff to follow up so that we can provide clarity in the future?
Absolutely, and it can be agendized for a further meeting.
Uh-huh. Perfect. Do I hear a motion to dismiss?
I'd like to agendize that for a future meeting. I'm still not sure. I mean, my personal opinion would not be to dismiss, Madam Chair. If others feel different, that's fine. I would think a letter of concern is more appropriate. Reminding them that every engineering document needs to be sealed per our rule. I don't think it's appropriate to do a letter of reprimand and all those things if we're not certain ourselves. But I certainly don't think this is good practice the way this was done.
So was that a motion that we can talk about, Dr. Angel?
Okay. I will make a motion for a letter of concern reminding the registrant to stamp all professional documents.
I second.
Okay, we've got a second from Mr. Huff. I'll open it up for discussion.
The question would be, what registrant are we talking about?
Mr. Rogers.
The respondent, Mr. Rogers and Ms. Schaefer, remind them to use their seal for our rules on any professional document.
Just a letter of concern. Is any discussion about this? Hearing none. Kurt, a roll call vote, please.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Aye.
Jack Gilmore.
Aye.
Neil Jones.
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Aye.
Stephen Knoll.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Helmut Hack.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Mr. Rogers, thank you for calling in and bringing up obviously what is a sticky situation. So we appreciate your input on this.
Thank you and board for your time today.
I would suggest now we can go to 5A1 since it's after 9:30. And I believe Mr. Kuhn might still be on the line.
All right, let's ask. Mr. Kuhn, are you on the line?
Star 6.
And star 6 if you're on your phone to unmute yourself.
Ask if Deanie's on the line too.
Yeah. And Deanie,
Deanie's on the line.
Okay. Hi, Deanie.
Hi, Deanie.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi.
I believe this is Mr. Kuhn here who is muted. Mr. Kuhn, to unmute yourself, press star 6 on your phone. And I also have a Marta Buchanan, if you're on the line.
And Sunita Krishna from the Attorney General's office is here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I can't unmute Mr. Kuhn. I don't have that ability to do that on my end. He has to unmute himself if he wishes to speak. And Marta Buchanan, are you on the line?
Could jump to
582
and then come right back if you'd like.
Yeah, maybe Mr. Kuhn can figure out his unmuting by then. Excellent.
And can we have a motion to table, please?
I don't think we've taken up the issue quite yet. So I don't think we need a motion to table.
Okay.
I believe perhaps we can go to 5AB while we wait for the respondents to 5A1 or 5A to join us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 5AB, Scott, are you taking the lead on this on our behalf?
Yes, as a matter of fact, and this should be a very quick matter for the board. And I'm not sure if the respondent or respondent's counsel is on the line, but respondent's counsel filed a motion to continue this due to her inability to attend today's meeting due to a prior commitment. Under the circumstances, the state had no objection to her motion to continue. So I would simply defer to the board as to whether or not to continue the matter.
Board members, that just as a reminder, we've continued this at least once before. So I think it perhaps at some point, if you agree, we should perhaps agree to this, but instruct our legal counsel that we'd like to proceed, perhaps at the next board meeting.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I believe I would need a motion if everybody thinks. The motion I'm looking for is to continue the hearing until the next meeting with the instructions that there should not be any more continuations barring an emergency.
So moved.
Excellent.
Second.
We got a motion and a second. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, can we have a roll call vote on 5B?
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Knoll?
Aye.
Andrew Everoad?
Aye.
Helmut Hack?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Wonderful. So let's go back to 5A and see if our call-ins are on the line and able to unmute themselves.
All right, let's see here. Mr. Kuhn? If you can hear me, this is Kurt Winter, the AZBTR. To unmute yourself, you need to hit star 6 on your phone.
You can ask another line. Can you hold on just a second?
Yes, please. I think that was Deanie.
It was.
Okay. Did we hear from
Deanie?
Did we hear that Mr. Kuhn
is
on another line? Did she say, or
I think that's what
right?
She said.
Okay. So she must be trying to get a hold of him on you.
Yeah.
Perfect. Excellent. Give them another couple minutes. See if we can echo 5A1.
Do we have any call-ins for B? It doesn't look like it.
I don't believe 6A, 3, and 4, or 6B have call-ins that I know of.
You can approve them.
B1 through B4, we have others on B3.
A, 3, and 4, and all of B.
Great.
Could be possible consent motions if somebody wants to move.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that we consent items cases 6A, 3, and 4, as well as cases 6B, 1, 2, 3, and 4, where we have signed consent agreements.
Second that, Chair.
Excellent. I have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion about these cases? Excellent. I don't hear any. Kurt, can we do a roll call vote on this consent, these consent items?
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Knoll?
Aye.
Andrew Everoad?
Aye.
Helmut Hack?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you, board members.
Meeting adjourned.
No, the meeting adjourned. 5A1. Jeannie, any update on our call-ins for 5A1?
Go ahead. Bye. And
you're breaking up, Deanie.
Thanks.
We're having some trouble all around with 5A1, aren't we? Well,
maybe we can hang up and call Mr. Kuhn.
This is Deanie. Did you hear me?
Now we can hear you, Deanie.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I still have Ms. Buchanan on the phone. She's taking the numbers to get a hold of Mr. Buchanan and see if she can get a hold of him and get him to call in. That's the best I can do right now.
Okay.
So if you want to wait, we can wait, or we can move ahead.
Well, board members, we actually got a letter from Mr. Kuhn explaining that he would like to sign the consent and that he had not received it in time. Is that currently...
I think
the letter
it's a,
you sent along, I thought.
It's already been signed, though.
Oh.
And that's why I didn't really understand the letter.
That's why
maybe
the word. Okay.
But Kramer might have something to say about
Mr. Kramer, would you like to fill us in?
And the PIN number is 776-047120. And he has to press star 6. I'm just going to let you go ahead and put me on hold or whatever you need to do.
I'm going to mute you, Deanie.
This was respondent was difficult to reach. In fact, I never did speak to him. I spoke to his office manager, Marta Buchanan, every time. Didn't respond to our notice of violation. I sent an email. She sent me back an email and said, Mr. Coon's been dealing with a family member's health issue and death. We did not receive your letter. I believe it was sent to the wrong address. Our post office box is such. Call me on my cell phone. I called her. I explained to her, walked her through the process of renewing her form of registration, which they did. But Mr. Kuhn, in his response, is saying, well, my address is Pepperwood. You should have that. That's the first I've ever heard of Pepperwood. It says Pepperwood. Why didn't Marta tell me when she responded to me? So it was just a matter of firm registration that they neglected. Mr. Kuhn's registration is up to date. Just sounds like an administrative thing that the office has let slip. They let it slip once before in 2016. So this is a repeat.
Okay, and we do have a signed consent agenda. And we also have a letter from the respondent saying he really did mean to sign it and he wanted to sign it, in essence, right?
In essence.
Okay. So unless Mr. Kuhn is on the line and wants to add any information, we do have a signed consent agreement in front of us as a board.
And star 6, Dean, if you need to unmute yourself, if you need to say something to the board.
Seems like all in all a amicable resolution, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Any board member questions?
Madam Chair, I just want to say I appreciate Mr. Kuhn's letter and understand his perspective and that he wasn't aware of it and didn't do it purposefully, so understood, and I think we should move on.
Excellent. Does that sound like a motion, Dr. Angel?
Yes, it is now, Carmen.
Second.
Move that we accept the signed consent.
And I heard a second from Mr. Jones. Excellent. Any discussion? Perfect. Kurt, a roll call vote, please.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Aye.
Jack Gilmore.
Aye.
Neil Jones.
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Aye.
Stephen Dole.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Helmut Hack.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Okay. Excellent. So, looking at our call-in list, the only one is a question on 9B, which is our legislative update. So I believe we are done with... Sorry, do we want to go to that, or do we, maybe we should tackle our licensing matters in 7. I apologize for jumping around. Hope you guys are following me.
This is Jeannie Ray. Thank you for your consideration on the Kuhn matter. I'm just going to sign off. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeannie.
Thank you, Jeannie.
All right. Bye-bye, all.
And this is Sunita Krishna from the Attorney General's Office. I will also disconnect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your help.
Bye, Sunita.
Thank you.
So we have items in 7 licensing matters. I will remind everybody that Mr. Tanner in 7G withdrew his application, so it's an old board item. So 7A through 7F it's in your board packet. It's not on the reprinted awesome agenda for you.
Right. The change of the agenda happened after the board packet was sent out, and it's just easier to inform you of the change than try to send out another packet. So too many packets, and it gets kind of crazy.
Would be great.
So are there any items of discussion in our 7 licensing matters?
Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we accept the recommendations for registration for the universal application.
Excellent. And those are 7A, 7B, and 7B. The rest exam items.
7A, 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
Thank you.
For clarity.
Way better. Thank you.
And B 1, 2, 3, 4?
Yes. I second that.
Oh, I see the...
Hey, I apologize. I had a hard time hearing the motion. Was that a motion to grant the licenses and all the 7As and the extensions in 7Bs?
Yes.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks for the clarification, Dr. Angel. Any discussion? Roll call vote, please.
Dr. Alejandro Angel.
Aye.
Jack Gilmore.
Aye.
Neil Jones.
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Aye.
Stephen Knoll.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Helmut Hack.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Okay. Okay. Eight is our licensing consent. These are all the items our wonderful staff has done in the last month.
Hi. Yes, can I request that the board omit one of the registrants from the canceled list for 8A1? He did recently renew, and he's current until 2024.
Excellent. What is his name and number, just for the record?
It is John Alexander, 38756.
So we need a motion for consent of 8A1 and 8A2 minus John Alexander's registration that will not be canceled.
I'll make a motion that we accept the cancellations for 8A1. Do we do a vote for 8A2? New?
Mm-hmm. We
do we normally do that?
No vote for 8A2.
Yeah, just for 8A1.
Perfect. Minus John Alexander?
Minus John Alexander, please.
Do I have a second?
Shall second.
Thank you. Excellent. Any discussion? Hearing none,
Dr. Alejandro Angel?
Aye.
Jack Gilmore?
Aye.
Neil Jones?
Aye.
Carmen Wyckoff?
Aye.
Stephen Knoll?
Aye.
Andrew Everoad?
Aye.
Helmut Hack?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Excellent. Melissa, I think you get to be up on pending
Melissa.
Legislation and questions from the public.
Okay.
I'm gonna call Patty to help.
No, I did it all myself. Thank you.
And I believe we do have someone who might be on the line for a 9B question.
I don't have any new information about the legislation that's listed on the agenda from the memo that I sent to you last week. I do expect that the governor signed that last bill that went up to him, which was in any case, I don't have the memo with me. I apologize for that. There is another piece of legislation that would define moral turpitude and make amendments to OWA statutes, and that was not on my list, but the AG's office will be getting a memo to all boards and commissions about how that new definition may or may not affect any formal hearing cases that the Office of Administrative Hearings hears for us. The law won't be effective until 90 days after session ends, and session has not ended. They haven't even started discussing the budget yet, so
it'd at least be August.
It will at least be August, maybe even late August, if they start moving the budget forward. The good news is that 1304, Senate Bill 1304, is not moving, which would have taken the engineers from this board and moved it to the Office of the Department of Administration. So that has not moved since it was introduced and passed in the initial committee.
Okay.
The other
bill... Does that mean it'll sit for a while until someone decides to move it forward, or is it going to just die there?
Probably dead.
It's probably dead, like Mr. Hack said. It could still move as session is still on,
yeah,
which is why we're still monitoring it.
Last year's surprises were really...
It's true. So I don't want to say it's dead for sure, but that's why I've been...
How does it die? Session ends and it's no action?
Yeah.
Correct. Correct.
So it doesn't come back next year unless someone reintroduces it?
Correct.
Okay.
So, and that's something obviously we can tackle if it comes back up, or even over the summer. If you have concerns, we should reach out and ask to be part of whatever discussions may take place about this bill or a similar one that could come back. Do you have any other specific questions about the bills?
If that passed, would this board be gone?
No, because this board would still be regulating the four other science and design professions, plus the home inspectors and the alarms. But you should know that operationally it would basically decimate this board because engineers are half of the registrant base, actually even more than that. They bring in over half the revenue. So you would lose over half your revenue and still have largely the same amount of work to do. So it would have a negative impact on this agency's ability to protect the public. And there's no indication that there would be any enforcement actions regarding potential public harm if engineers move to the Department of Administration. There was nothing mentioned in there about state enforcement. The enforcement would have been relegated to a private entity. And that brought up a lot of antitrust questions. Would all registrants, all engineers then, have to be a member of the private entity to be subject to their jurisdiction? And that doesn't flow well given the North Carolina Dental Board case, which said associations and private entities that promote the profession really shouldn't. It doesn't look good for them to be regulating or enforcing against their own, because the protectionism issue was a big concern. So those were some of the issues that were raised when the bill was heard initially in committee, and it hopefully is a reason why it hasn't moved.
Thank you for the update.
Okay.
Do we have, I believe there was a public caller who might be on the line, Austin Mingle. If you happen to be with us, star 6, unmute.
Yes, I am. This is Austin Mingle.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, I understand you have questions.
I was asked on behalf of, I work for the town of Prescott Valley up here in northern Arizona. And we were hoping that the board might be able to provide a little bit further clarification on the Arizona statute for exemptions in 32-144. Specifically, we've heard interpretations over the years, which is probably a problem anyways, but, specifically what we've been asked recently was, it states to the outside surface of exterior walls, and does that include areas that are, for example, a covered patio? And the specific case that has come up recently was like in the case of a duplex, which would not be exempt because it's not a detached single-family dwelling. So since it's a multifamily, do those covered patios that people like to add on to them include in that cover of 3,000 square feet? I guess that would be the crux of it. And then that could spill over into other areas. If you had a commercial project, a restaurant that had outdoor seating, would that area be included as well? And I guess there's confusion. Different people interpret things that they shouldn't be, and we're just hoping that maybe there was somewhere where we could get a little more clarification on the specific intent of what is written there.
So I'd like to defer to our lawyer for some advice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The board, unfortunately, really can't give any kind of a hypothetical interpretation of board statutes. It is up to the board to interpret their statutes, but it can only really do that when presented with an enforcement matter. Otherwise, the issue is the board could give an indication of an interpretation, but no future board is bound by that. The board, nobody would be bound by that, and so the board would be in a position of providing a hypothetical answer, and at the next board meeting, the registrant could be found to be in violation regardless. So the board really can't get into providing hypotheticals for people or proactive interpretations. If the matter came up for enforcement, then the board will be able to determine whether something did constitute a violation in that case or the specifics of that case.
Okay. Mr. Donald, but can we provide some guidance to people, or that's why we used to do substantive policies, because I'm not thinking of a specific hypothetical, but I do have the way I read the statement or the statute, and is it fair to share how I read it?
Dr. Angel, certainly any board member can share how they read the statute. The danger is going to be nobody can actually rely upon that.
That's right.
And mm-hmm. that could put the public at risk of relying upon a board, relying upon something that somebody says, this is how I'm interpreting it. And then if they go and do something based upon that, and a future board finds them in violation, they would then go back and say, but board members told me that this, you know, they were interpreting it this way. So I would be cautious with that.
And what about the substantive policy avenue?
The board certainly could issue a substantive policy statement. Now, again, the board is not bound by a substantive policy statement, but a substantive policy statement is designed to give the public an indication of how the board is viewing or how they are interpreting a certain rule or statute at a certain point in time. So certainly yeah. the board could come up with a substantive policy statement if they would like. That would be something they could agendize for next meeting and then discuss and come up with a potential statement and then vote to issue it.
Mr. Mangles, thank you for calling in. How often, what a pain is this for you? How often does it come up, or was it a specific item that just made you come to us?
Honestly, it comes up a couple times a year. I mean, there's confusion, I guess, especially when it comes into ones that aren't directly commercial. I mean, everybody is pretty confident when it comes to commercial. If it's over 3,000, they just do it anyways.
Right.
But like with the smaller multifamilies, especially duplexes, it's come up quite a few times in the last couple of years. I can think of probably four instances in the last two where the questions come up. And that's in a small town here, so I can't imagine, you know, in different larger jurisdictions how that might be. But it just seems like it's a question that we get asked and we can't answer, and there is no answer. So it would be nice to have some kind of policy. I mean, anything that helps and doesn't lead to people interpreting what they shouldn't be interpreting.
Sure.
To me, it would be a good thing.
Now, the duplexes, do they have, like, homeowners associations?
Usually not, not here at least. I don't know about other places. It's just you know, a duplex on a single or a multifamily lot owned by one individual. Typically,
my experience with surveying and working with some of these, you know, the clients and that, it's clearly up to the city to describe what they want to do in that. This is kind of a general. I do have a list of the whole Article 3,
yeah.
but. Carports, I would say, would not be included in that measurement, but that's just based on cities I've dealt with. So it seems like the city needs to figure it out themselves and come up with their own plan, what they want, but 3,000 square feet
okay.
is a lot.
Mr. Parlins, did you?
Yeah, I mean, our method is we take the building area at this point and just include all covered portions that are basically to the exterior of a beam or wall, meeting the definition from the IBC for building area is the closest that we come to for enforcement, because it seems to cover all circumstances.
Being consistent with other town policies seems like a great start, considering that we can't officially weigh in.
Right.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Dr. Angel?
I did want to provide one piece of input, or two. One is, Mr. Heck is right that the board provides minimum requirements and then the town is free to implement other requirements how they see fit. I think in this specific case, regardless of whether it's a covered patio or carport or other thing, the way I personally read the statute, and this goes with all the disclaimers that Mr. Donald asked that we include, this is not my opinion, is that the statute talks about designing of a structure. And so to me, if that patio, carport, or anything is part of the structure and relies on the same roof system, or same support system, then it all counts in the 3,000. If it's not part of the same structure, then it's not.
Okay.
I agree.
Mr. Barlington, okay.
Yeah, I just, Madam Chair, I just want to state for the record that I do get calls related to this issue on a fairly regular basis from cities and counties. So it's, this is why it's coming to the board. I think it does need to be addressed and clarified somehow.
So perhaps if board members concur, we can add that to our agenda for a future item.
I think that's a good idea, just to clarify it for people.
Well, Mr. Mangles, thanks for bringing us an interesting question. I appreciate it.
So this is
thank you.
Whether they need a registrant to do the project?
Yeah, what the cutoff is for 3,000 square feet, therefore taking in the registrant requirements.
Yeah, think of the kind of type of builders that are doing these things, trying to skirt around it.
I do love a 5,000 square foot pergola. That's enough out of me, right? What else do we have? Melissa, I think we're back to you.
Oh,
aren't we?
I
think we are through the.
I'm out of practice.
A lot of the officials.
No, did you want to do the other items in number six, all the enforcement
actions?
We did.
Yep. You stepped out for 2 seconds and it was done.
Oh my God, you guys are rocking it today.
Okay.
60 actually did not make it onto the official agenda.
Okay.
So, no, 6C will be an interesting one when that comes back.
Well, I have a document for 6C.
Absolutely. So I think
is important for it.
I'll add it to the...
Actually, I've got it labeled. There's two on there.
Okay. Excellent. So 6C, that didn't make our final published agenda, so that will be next month. Next month also has a hearing according to our continuation. So if the board members, please clear your Tuesday.
Sorry, Judith.
Sorry, Judith.
Excellent.
Did you have, I don't know if everyone had a chance to read the director's report. Good.
Do you want to give us a synopsis?
Sure. The annual meetings for all the national councils will begin and are ramping up. We're not sure if NCARB is going to have an actual in-person meeting yet. They're supposed to let us know. I had heard through the rumor mill it would be in LA, but I don't have confirmation of that yet from NCARB. And there is an interim meeting that's taking place on May 1st, some kind of credentialing meeting that Carmen is going to vote. They want to repeal an old policy statement they had in place coming out against the registration of interior designers. So now they're trying to be more inclusive and will try to repeal that part of their model law that would prevent their support of registration if interior designers in various states want to become registered. We heard about an attempt some years back, and AIA was not in support of the legislation and it didn't go anywhere here. And since Arizona has been all about deregulation, they have not attempted to obtain registration in Arizona in about, I would say, at least 5 years, possibly longer. NCS is having a virtual zone meeting on May 13, and Alejandro will be the voting delegate for us. Mr. Hack, if you would like to take part in that, we can try to get you also signed up for that. Okay.
Yeah.
And their annual meeting looks like it will take place in person in New Orleans, but they are limiting the number of people from each board that are allowed to go. At previous annual meetings, they invited almost every board member to go, but they will only allow two delegates from each state. But that would work. Yeah. Mr. Hack could attend. And
I'd rather do the virtual.
And you can. I think they'll also have an option for virtual. And if Alejandro is still on the board, then the engineer board member. I'm not sure. The governor's office did indicate that they were planning to appoint new people. Because, again, when they appointed Mr. Hack, I said, thank you to them for doing that and what asked about the status of the other open positions, which there are 8 of them on this board. Jack was reappointed and Carmen's term is still valid in Mr. Hack, but all the rest of the members are still serving because you're dedicated to public protection. So, yes, and it looks like the CLARB annual meeting is going to take place here in Phoenix. So, yeah, convenient. And Julie will probably attend and we'll see if CLARB has a limitation on the number of people. But if you want to attend, obviously the invitation will probably be there. And they may reach out to the board since we're the host state to welcome people or take part in a larger way than we may have in the past since the meeting will be here. So more info. ASBOG is actually having an interesting meeting that's going to take place next week about going to computer-based testing, which would be great for us because our board incurs a fair amount of staff time and money basically proctoring the ASBOG exams for that organization. And if they can make computer-based testing available to their candidates, it would relieve our staff and probably make the candidates happier because, as you know from the other national councils providing that service, application candidates can go, I'm not sure if ASBOG yet is going to say the test can only be administered twice a year or if you can go at any time like NCARB candidates can and take the test. But more information will be forthcoming after that meeting takes place. So that's pretty exciting. Really looking forward to that. Do you guys have any other? Okay. And then I know Jason was always interested to know how many of the state-specific surveying exams we provide every month. This month, 5 people have taken the exam. And Dolly, that's pretty much normal, right?
Yeah. Well, during the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is Rob's last board meeting. So, yeah.
Speech.
We're going to miss him, and yet we're happy that he's going to move on to more passion projects that he has lined up and wish him well. So, and he's always helped me with my magic numbers about the budget. So you saw that at the beginning of the report that our budget's in pretty good shape. Applications have gone up overall. This year, Rob had indicated we had about 2,500 applications last year, and there are almost 35.
We're on pace for about 3,500. I think the
influx.
What's up for the influx of obviously population, the migration here, and then the pandemic. Yeah, people opening up. Yeah, it's probably Californians. Yeah.
Yeah, they might lose the governor.
I swear. I had like eight back to you. For 7 years, every time I check these applications, I would say 90% of mine that I get are from out of state.
I rarely see
anybody from Arizona.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
don't
unusual.
Forget.
Or do you get them? Do you get the ones from Arizona?
I get them. There's a good deal of Arizonans, but many of the Arizonans are just kind of a rubber stamp.
Yeah.
The good applications are the interesting ones,
the
right?
Exam.
Right.
Pretty much
most apply directly to NCARB to take the exams. You get the weird ones.
Yeah, okay.
The ones that we need. We need your experience and expertise to weigh in on.
I went to town on a couple of them.
Very good. We always appreciate that. So you probably noted that we are in process of trying to recruit application evaluators just to have people to reach out to in case you guys can't do it for whatever reason, so we're not delaying the processing of applications. And
do we have a link or something that our board board members can share on LinkedIn, or is this like personal network you want? How do you want us to help find them?
Well, what we're planning is to reach out to current EAC members first, because those are obviously registrants who have expressed an interest in doing board work. So,
And Julia did already do that.
Yeah,
cool.
She's been reaching out and
working on a training packet type of thing, just as a guide for new evaluators.
Excellent.
Yep.
Do you have any architects you've contacted?
Not yet, not architects. I think the main ones that we've reached out to were land surveyors, landscape architects, and geologists for now.
Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the licensing figures in the report on in the third column, we've included the average number of calendar days to grant licensure, and you'll see geologists win this month, and landscape architects were up there. That's the average number of days, but there are categories where we're able to process the applications pretty quickly, like home inspectors and the alarms. Because they have easier application requirements.
And geologists don't have a council record, which makes it hard.
Right.
So, as well. So it's not on you, Steve. It's not just not just you. It's partial.
No. So we are looking for ways to make the process easier and faster, more efficient. And we've been doing that now for a while. So we're going to recruit, hopefully, a group of individuals who can help. If we need more candidates, then obviously we can ask you guys to reach out if EAC members aren't willing to or able to do it. We've also made payment available, and that was part of the budget request we submitted last year, anticipating that the membership of the board would go public and that we wouldn't have the expertise, that we would love to pay people to help us do our work if necessary, not to undermine the volunteers who help us, but to offset in case we need a geologist or landscape architect or a surveyor or, you know, God forbid, an architect, that sort of thing.
So would you say that geologist was 89 days?
That was this month.
But there's also a small sample size. I think it's based on 5 grants. Also have to realize when we get an application in, we do have to wait for the references to come in for all geologists.
That's part of the time.
And that's part of the time.
Because I'm about 2 weeks maybe.
Yeah,
and that's
not
so
your fault.
We may have to wait 80 days. We may have to wait 80 days for to get their final reference. And that's part of the issue. So, or a test score or something from Nevada, something like that.
So. Right. So there are a lot of factors that weigh into the average number of days, but we wanted you to be aware of that, given those may be questions that come up in the sunset this agency will be looking at in 2013. So it's good for you to have those statistics and those possible explanations if questions about why did it take 89 days for a geologist to get granted, then hopefully you'll have the information available to present. All that's pretty important. So, and we do still have the rules in place, those timeframes rules, which were written, granted, a long time ago, but it actually had worked very much in favor of the applicants, especially during the pandemic, where everything slowed down. If they had submitted an application and they couldn't get references or test scores or verifications from states that were closed, then we were not required to close their application or deny them because we had enough time built into those rules years ago. Which isn't to say we shouldn't look at those rules for updating in the future, but it did work to the benefit of the candidates this past year.
During the pandemic, NCARB usually has about a 1 week, 2 week turnaround when you request a transmittal if you guys want reciprocity. They were about a 60-day lag at one point. So we would get an application and we'd be waiting 60 days to get that transmittal over so we could complete the application. So that affected it, but luckily our time frames did allow, so to your point.
So does that talk to the point where they think that people working at home are more efficient?
Yes.
things like that are really slowed down. I see it here in the state.
They have, and at NCARB, they actually scan.
Like for the resources.
They manually scan stuff. To my knowledge at NCARB, when I was out there, they go find your file and they print it out, then they scan to a specific state based on the most up to date.
Wow.
So when you're not, when you're especially in DC, when you're, that's where they're located, you can't, a lot of people were working from home, so they were not.
Couldn't do it.
And that's my guess, so.
And we've seen it too. I think I informed you last month that there was a survey the state sent out about office space. And during the pandemic, the larger agencies who are on general fund had more resources and were able to send their staff home because they have computer systems that were not as paper intensive as ours. Mm-hmm. So while we did have COVID protections in place for staff, and we did let staff rotate on and off at home, because our process was paper intensive, we had a lot of presence still here at the board and we were able to process our work. But some of the larger agencies have felt that work from home is the way to go. So the state is going to look at downsizing office space, and that may affect this agency at some point because we do have a fairly large amount of office space relative to the number of staff that we have. I heard from Asset this week that they're going into a hoteling system and will be downsizing some of the Department of Administration staff, allowing many to work from home and many to, or some to come in and work in this hotel staff place.
It's the new architectural buzzword. We're doing hoteling too.
Yeah.
It just means you don't get a desk with your picture on it.
Right. You can't have any personal stuff in your office. I, you know, if that's the wave of the future, great. I just hope that the state will be able to maintain its efficiencies and make sure the public is safe and people who need state services are able to get them when lots of staff is teleworking. So we'll see.
It also shows the importance of our conversion to computer.
Exactly.
21st century maybe.
Exactly. So anyway,
21 years into the 21st century.
I know, exactly. And we're the Board of Technical Administration. But, you know, it is what it is.
We don't regulate computers.
Right. Exactly. Our licensee numbers fluctuate month by month, but not by a large amount. This month, we're down 237 from last month, but last month we were up. So
it's a delinquency.
It is,
end of the
renewal
cycle as well. The big renewal.
Firms, the numbers have gone up actually, even though this month they're down slightly. When I recall starting this report, we only had about 5,000 firms, and now we're up at around 6,000. So I think that's positive, and hopefully good for the economy.
Split from the big firms.
That's right. Not to ignore enforcement, we're working on 52 complaints. 43 are against registrants and 9 against non-registrants. And Deanie has rocked it, and there are only 5 cases pending formal hearing.
Yay!
And that number may go down given that one has signed a consent agreement. So we'll see, depending on pending cases. And did you want to add anything, Doug, to enforcement? We're good?
Awesome.
Okay.
Hey, Melissa, I have a question for you. On the registration numbers, do you keep a separate accounting of the universal applications that are passed?
Yes. And the governor's office actually asks for that information on a quarterly basis.
Yeah.
You've been saving that, right?
Yeah, we have it in our database. We can query. I want to guess about 90 so far since the law has gone in. And you guys have, you guys see it every month, but maybe an average of 3-4 a month.
Yeah.
What kind of percentage would that be?
It's very low.
It's really low, yeah.
Probably about 2% of grants, maybe.
You're saying 3,500 for just this year, and
yeah.
You're at 90.
Yeah. And
but
that's
90 in 2 years, yeah. So 2% maybe. Yeah.
Universal licensure.
Yeah. That maybe came a little off.
Okay. But that is a topic other states are interested in because of legislation pending.
Yeah.
Universal licensure.
for the next meeting?
Yeah, if you want.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions? I did include the cash flow report, which is the most accurate review of our expenses and revenues. So, I know, right? It's actually a really big spreadsheet. So to print it, it is pretty small. But you'll see that we have an ending fund balance now of 4 million, almost 800,000. That's basically our savings account, and that's what we need to use to move to an automated computer system. And
buy us lunch too.
I wish, but we've tried that, Neil, and you know they keep saying no. And we're in good shape from in terms of how much we've spent of our appropriation. We've only spent 61%, and we're almost 80% through fiscal year. So I think we are frugal in how we spend our money, and you may want to consider other spending ideas as the year goes on. We have had vacancy savings, obviously, because Patty left, and now Rob and I are leaving, and we're the biggest drag on on your personal services, which accounts for about half of our money. Where we spend half of our money is on.
Isn't there a bill where the governor's office or somebody's going after some of that extra cash?
Yes.
That's still an issue?
No. Actually, I think that some of the larger agencies said, no, we that's not economically viable.
Good.
So we'll see.
You get to save it then.
So far, we'll see. But it does affect whether we get the additional requests for expenditures that we ask for in our annual budget. And that's largely why, because we always have a fund balance that rolls over from our checking account to mm-hmm. our savings account, why our appropriation hasn't increased in
so
the
we,
past
we
few
could,
years.
I mean, strategically, we know we need to get digital, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, we may have been very frugal, and this may be the big year.
Right.
To make some expenditures.
Right. So if I had stayed, I would have put forward a request to move to Salesforce.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully Judith will consider that moving forward. The agency has been pushed to go to the e-licensing platform that 13 smaller boards are on.
Mm-hmm.
And our research has indicated that would not be satisfactory for this agency because of the 7 license types, the 30 different applications, and it's all
hey,
about
Melissa,
budget.
But why would that not be appropriate? I mean, it's handling 13 different agencies. They obviously all have different license types and application formats. Why? I mean, and I'm if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I'd like to understand why that's a problem.
Okay, well, we could talk about it more specifically next month. Scott's waving me off about that. And if you have questions before, you can always call me, and I'll tell you what I know thus far. It may work, but we've been doing a lot of research. So
I know you've been diving into it for a few months, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, so anyway, other than that.
Melissa, I have a question. I had in my calendar legal assignment and making sure we can keep Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Like, isn't there some IGA or something we have to do to reserve him?
The ISA. The AG's office normally sends us ISAs, interagency service agreements, for signatures at the end of June.
Mm-hmm.
For the beginning of a fiscal year.
Okay.
So we haven't gotten anything yet, but when we do, I'm sure we'll come to you with that, and you know, you can
with a lot of change ahead. I appreciate his continuity.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, we agree. So,
but Scott, we can't talk about that right now.
Right, it's not on the agenda. It's not on the agenda. Yes. So, just a reminder, if you want to go to the annual meetings, let me know. I'm going to sign up Mr. Hack and probably Alejandro for the annual meeting for NCs. That's due by May 7. But so far, I haven't gotten any other you must sign me up or die requests from the councils yet. But if I do, I'll email you. Okay. And any other questions? I'm kind of excited I got to talk about the director's report this month.
Since Rob's continued service is on the agenda, I think we can glow about him for a moment. I just want to say thank you, especially when Melissa was out and we were looking for a new executive director and I was a deer in headlights. I personally want to thank you for sticking around and putting off your passion projects a little bit and bailing us out. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Staff appreciates it too.
Good thing you're wearing your mask.
I know. That's why I'm keeping it on.
Cool.
I'll see my cheeks. I'll come back.
Be
yes, you will.
Me?
Come back with Christmas
card. You won't miss me.
I got your phone number.
But thank you.
You do.
I
think we
have extra money. I was going to ask if that was your personal cell. So.
Which one?
Was your cell your personal cell?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. We can't get away then. Excellent.
cool.
Any other
Thank you.
Questions or comments for today?
Judith does start officially on Monday. So.
Yay, on Monday. I'll be there in full force. Yay.
And I'm hanging out for a couple weeks at least to answer questions and help her transition. I may or may not see you next month, but...
But you may, because I may be holding onto her ankles while she tries to leave the building.
I think it would actually make sense if you were here for at least her first board meeting.
You think?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Neil. We'll see. We should hear about an oral argument schedule.
I have two cases that I think we should look at.
Okay.
We do have a question here. The Mills update did bump off of this agenda, right?
Right.
So that is something that perhaps we can take a look at in May? Is that the plan?
We do look at that every month. Okay. I did speak with Mr. Harris, and he had no new updates. So okay. That's why it came off the agenda.
So how did that come about? Was that a complaint we filed against Mills and then the attorney?
That's not on the agenda, so our attorney is giving me an email.
Okay. I just wanted to see if he could do it.
So if we could put on the agenda for next month maybe a short update,
sure.
That would be awesome.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Excellent. Anything else for the good of the board?
Well, we also talked about record drawings, right? And
yep.
Discussing that for
yep.
next agenda.
Yep. And there was another one I wrote down that you wanted to consider.
We had some good ones. We had Mr. Mangles and how much is 3,000 square feet and what counts. We had now the Mills update and the
computer system discussion.
The computer system? Excellent.
Yeah.
And records as built. And we have a hearing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And are the 3,000 feet measured in international feet or U.S. feet?
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're on the suggested topics for future meetings?
Well, I believe we are.
Yeah.
I
have a question for you,
mm-hmm.
And it may be a legal question that we should consider for the future meeting. The board, some years ago, when I became executive director, voted to give me certain delegated authority. And I think now that Judith will be assuming the responsibilities, perhaps they should refresh those votes. You know, it's, but I don't know if it's necessary.
Probably be safe.
It's one of those things that, quite frankly, the board would have authorized the executive director, not the individual.
Okay, so you
it
think
should,
it's fine?
It should continue
okay.
the position. The board can always revisit at any time to see what, you know, if they'd like to revisit delegated authority, but I don't think there's going to be any issue with continuity
Great.
In the position.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure,
okay.
not to forget that if you felt it was necessary.
Yeah, I mean, the board can always revisit it on a future agenda, but
they don't need to.
There's
and
not going
to
be any gap in continuity
That's great.
Between executive directors.
Cool. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So your free lunches will go off to the next director.
Yeah, all those free lunches that we got, right? Thank you.
Scott, you got number 12?
A couple of things on number 12. The first, there actually is an update on the open meeting law complaint this month. The update is that I was contacted by a new employee of the prosecutor's office who has taken over the file, she is notified me she was taking over the file, and I would expect to be hearing something before too long. So the update is evidently there's been a change in personnel, and now they are moving forward again.
Oh,
on B, B is a topic I wanted to have on here for training, kind of general board of training. And actually, it's a little bit of a misnomer. It's not just loss of absolute immunity, it's loss of immunity.
Okay.
There are two types of immunity. There's absolute, and then there's qualified. The absolute would be more akin to it, more tied to a judicial function. So the only time really absolute would come into play with the board would be if the board were exercising its judicial function, arguably. Then there would be a question of whether or not the members have absolute immunity for making a decision in an adjudicatory situation. For the most part, what I'm going to be talking about is qualified immunity. And that is what protects you as individuals from somebody, a registrant, a non-registrant, coming back and filing a lawsuit against you for something you do as a member of this board. Effectively, the board is, again, we're a state agency. The goal of the state agency is to operate in a transparent fashion, performs a regulatory function across multiple professions, and you do have the ability to take away or grant property rights in a license or registration, and you have the ability to take action against individuals. You can impose fines. You can also pursue individuals who have not registered with you in certain circumstances. So it's important that you understand your qualified immunity from any of these people coming after you individually. There are two different areas where this comes into play in Arizona. The largest one is under your own statutes. You have qualified immunity under ARS 32.110. It's immunity from personal liability. It's a specific tech board statute. Members, agents, employees of the board, advisory committees, and other statutorily established committees of the board, and volunteers are going to have qualified immunity with respect to acts done and actions taken in good faith and within the scope of their authority. Those are going to be the two key points that you always want to pay attention to: good faith and scope of your authority.
So, Scott, when you give us the evil eye, that's keeping us within the scope of our authority?
Well, that goes to both, actually, good faith and scope of the authority, and that is exactly why I give you the evil eye, because my job is to help protect you guys from going coloring outside the lines, so to speak.
Okay.
Now, at the same time, what that means is if you're ever unsure, ask for legal advice. If I give you legal advice, essentially, I'm giving you cover. If you follow my legal advice, you are acting in good faith, unless I tell you something that is just blatantly, objectively, obviously wrong. If I tell you it's okay to go out in the street and shoot somebody, don't follow that. Or if you do follow that, you're not going to get protected by the state.
Okay.
But if I give you legal advice with regards to any of your statutes, even if you make a decision that turns out later to be wrong, but if you're following my legal advice, you guys are going to be in good shape because you're acting in good faith. The opposite is also true. If you do not follow my legal advice, then you are really going to have a hard time arguing you're acting in good faith. So if I give you legal advice with regards to a statute, and this has happened before with different boards, if the board says we want to go ahead and we're going to move this case to a hearing, even though we're, you know, we can't tell you what the actual violation is, but we think this guy violated this no matter what. The Assistant Attorney General, if they give legal advice, there's no basis for this, and the board insists on moving forward, I would actually at that point have to stand up and leave the room because I cannot be present while the board does something illegal if I'm aware it's illegal. Mm-hmm. If that ever happens, you know you're in trouble. So if I get up and leave the room, and it's not because we're taking a break.
Your lawyer runs away, you are in trouble. Yes.
Exactly.
Good advice.
Exactly.
You gotta walk with them.
But Scott, yep. Scott, you would say that though, right?
I would be very clear about it, yes.
Yeah.
I would be extraordinarily
that's
clear.
That's important.
And I would be very clear, and I would probably give you 2 to 3 opportunities to make sure you understood.
Okay.
So the board has never even come close.
Right.
So you guys have not even ever come close. This has happened in a couple of situations, other boards, which is why I want to bring it up. But you guys have been very, very good. There's no question I've ever had so far about you guys violating any of this. I just want to make sure. Oh, yes?
But if somebody frivolously comes into my office and serves me with a lawsuit because of something that I did here,
mm-hmm.
Do I just call you and take care of it?
I don't
have to pay any money. I don't have to get my own attorney.
Right. What I,
any of that stuff.
Right. What you would do is you would contact me and you would contact the executive director.
Okay.
I believe it would go to risk management.
It
I'm not entirely
does.
Certain of the flow at that point, but right, the state would provide your attorney. You'd be represented by the attorney general's office, unless for some reason they sent it to outside counsel. But yeah, you would be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those lawsuits are always against the position meals. Is filling, right? Not Neil himself,
well,
or
they,
something like that, right?
Well, they
it doesn't keep
capacity.
Somebody from doing it anyway.
Right?
Well,
yeah,
no, they sure. Me at my office.
Yeah, they would sue. They would typically what they would do is sue the board. They would sue the executive director, the deputy director, the investigator, the board members, anybody whose name they had. They tend to throw on these, but at that point you're protected by the state if you're acting in good faith and within your statutory guidelines. And again, the big question is always whether or not you asked your attorney if you were unsure about a statute. And it's my job also to make sure, you know, to be following things and to make sure you're not doing something you shouldn't. And again, you've never even come close. But that is qualified if you do that. If you act in good faith within your actual statutory scope of authority, you have qualified immunity for any discretionary acts that you take within your role as a board member. Now, things to keep in mind, this has to do with any investigations, certainly, granting licenses, taking away licenses. Where you can get into trouble is, and we've talked before about things like conflicts of interest.
Mm-hmm.
This is where conflicts of interest become kind of important because you want to make sure that you're notifying us of conflicts of interest. And I'll be doing a more in-depth training in conflicts of interest in the future. But things like that, you want to just make sure you get on the record. You know, if your former brother-in-law comes up before the board and you don't mention it, that can be a big problem in the future. So things like that, you want to make sure you mention to the board. But effectively, again, the key is acting in good faith within the scope of your authority. What the public looks at is whether the board is acting in an arbitrary and capricious manner. Are you treating registrants equally? Are you following your statutes? These are the type of things that that you want to watch out for. That said, and that's really kind of a quick overview. I mean, additionally, there also is under ARS 41-621, the state also specifies that it's obtaining insurance. It's statutorily required to obtain insurance to protect you guys. So if for whatever reason the board loses a lawsuit, if you're acting in good faith and you're following your statutory mandate, the state covers all costs, all losses, all of that. Now that said, I know that's a lot to drop all of a sudden, but are there any questions about any aspect of that?
I get it. Yeah.
Wrote down, obey Scott.
That's my bad. See what the lawyer says.
That would have been a much
much shorter training, I could have
just said. It's good they understand.
Scott, regarding the conflicts,
yep.
You mentioned if you put it out in a show, let's say it is your brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. You say, this is my brother-in-law, but I think I can act fairly. Is that sufficient, or should you just step away from it?
Well, there. When it comes to conflicts, there are two things. There's a statutorily defined conflict, which specifies different relationships and then pecuniary or other interests. There are specific. There's an actual statutory. If you don't, you know, you're in violation of that statute. Additionally, there's also the appearance of impropriety, which is, it's not really a statutory conflict, but it's something where if you were a registrant, or if you filed a complaint with the board, and for example, if you led the discussion on the board and you argued, we need to dismiss this, there's nothing here whatsoever, and it turned out, the complainant found out later that the registrant in question was your brother-in-law. You know, it's something, can they then come after you? Well, there's a gray area, but it leaves you potentially in some
problem. But in a case something like that, you mention it, then would you come out and say, maybe you should step aside, or?
If you've mentioned it in advance, the keys to conflict of interest, first off, I can't declare a conflict for anybody, only the individual can determine if they have a conflict. What I generally say is the safest course of action is if you were the complainant or the registrant and you found out whatever it is you know about the person on the board, would you feel comfortable that, you know, with that person hearing your case for the board? So if you were a registrant and you came here and found out that you know, Neil's sister was the licensee you were complaining about, and Neil didn't mention anything about it, would you think that potentially
that would
be a
real problem?
Now, what you would do in that case is there are a couple of different things. First off, you can just declare, you know, this certainly could be a conflict, so I'm going to step back. Now, if we get into a quorum issue, there's also frustration purpose of the board. You know, we can have a situation where too many people are conflicted, and then the board can't actually ever handle the complaint. That frustrates the purpose of the board. In that circumstance, you could come forward and say, well, I do have this conflict I announced on the record. I'm going to restate it on the record, and I'm stating I believe that I can be impartial regardless of it. This is not going to influence my ability to be objective. If you put that on the record, the presumptive is you're able to be objective. So the board does have mechanisms for
And that could happen, Scott,
sure.
Right?
Oh,
if,
yeah.
Like, we got a complaint against one of you,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
that
oh, sure.
if every board member had to recuse
wow.
because
yeah.
they either liked or didn't like Neil, you know,
sure.
then we
yeah.
could
yeah.
never
Poor
adjudicate
Sam.
That complaint,
Poor Sam.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. Or if it was somebody, if there was a complaint against a major firm that
right.
several people had interacted
yeah.
with, you
yeah.
know,
right.
people there,
right.
yeah, absolutely, that can happen. And so this isn't a very infrequent situation. It certainly can come up.
Yeah.
It's just always best to look at the situation, and if there's a statutory conflict, then you definitely want to call a conflict, declare a conflict.
Can we talk to you beforehand, or is it
sure.
happening during the meeting?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am available at any time, with the exception of vacations and weekends. you can always call me. You can email me. I'm board counsel. If you're concerned about something, shoot me an email. You can CC the executive director as well. We can figure out where to go with things. Absolutely. And it's like anything else in law, it is infinitely better to deal with these things up front than try to fix them later.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
And I know in the past, because you guys are appointed, because you've been doing you've been practicing in your profession for a while, there may be instances where you know a registrant who's being investigated, or you know a complainant because you've worked with them. And I know you have in the past said, well, I know that firm or I know that licensee, but I feel I can be fair and impartial. And that goes to Scott's disclosure comment. As long as the public knows.
Yeah, and it's not something that, you know, obviously you guys have been in industry and you know a lot of people. And if something comes up, a complaint against a firm, and hey, you know the firm, you've been practicing in this field for decades, but there's nothing that, you know, it would have to be more than just recognition of the firm name that would call into question. But if there's something that, generally the rule of thumb I use for the appearance of impropriety really is, if you were the guy sitting at this end of the table and you knew that that situation existed, would you think there was any reason to believe that person couldn't be impartial?
Yeah. Well, it's good to be able to talk to you beforehand and rethink through this, because I mean, we haven't thought about this probably in months or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And again, it's always, again, with the, it goes back to the qualified immunity as well. If you talk to your lawyer in advance, you know, that can certainly help with the good faith aspect.
Cool.
Very good.
But again, nobody has really gotten even close to, you know, I mean, you guys have been fantastic. You're a wonderful board to work with, no fears whatsoever. I hardly even had it slam my hand down on the table.
Thank you, Scott.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Scott about that? No? Good. Thank you.
Sure. With 13, we have a home inspector meeting on May 4th, and we're looking for our fifth member. I've asked Clarence, but he's never responded. I was looking at the statute, and it lists that it has to be an architect or an engineer, as well as a public member, which I
think
Bruce
was on there. Well, we already sucked Andy into it, so.
Right. He's kind of stuck because it's a public member. But. 13 standing committee report? Although there's no information in there, because it hasn't happened yet, the home inspector.
It's just on the agenda, Neil.
The agenda. Not affected.
Okay, so.
So, an architect or an engineer, if anyone's interested.
I already took on two.
Yeah.
Neil? I nominate Neil.
I could reach out to Clarence some more, as, you know, and see if I can ring him in.
Not here.
Yeah. No, it's Clarence as well. But both their terms have expired, so we're waiting to see who gets appointed.
It's something you would let us know pretty quickly.
Yes.
Or Judith would.
Right.
We really need to know.
Yeah. Yep.
But for vacation purposes.
I have a plan.
So the committee hasn't met for a while, and you'll have a report at the May meeting about what they discuss and how it goes. So, great. On item 14, I was wondering, since ABET and the Land Surveyor Task Force, really, do you want to see those items on the next month's agenda? We don't have really anything to report. You know, ABET was a particular interest of Gene's, and now that he's not here, we rarely hear about what goes on. ABET is the accrediting, engineering and surveying accrediting institution that reviews the credentials of the programs the kids, applicants graduate from. So,
It wouldn't hurt if something came across your desk just to tell us.
Oh, yeah. I think in the director's report, we would certainly include what info we find out about those organizations for your information. And you probably noticed in my director's report that I have asked for an update about the proposal to enter into rulemaking for the new proposed surveying boundary minimum standards, but we haven't heard anything back from the governor's office on that.
Yeah, so. I'd be inclined just keeping the standards as is.
And not entering into rulemaking?
I would not promote.
Well, and that may very well end up being the case, because if we don't get permission from the governor to open those up for comment and possible revision, we won't be able to do that.
I just went through rulemaking at my other board. It was pretty painful. In lieu of that, can we provide more, like, more of our substantial policies or like some more? Because we get so many questions that our rules are just not super clear.
Right, which is really the best reason to enter into rulemaking, because as rules age and the practice changes or statutes change or something federally happens.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, ultimately, the substantive policy statements are really meant as a very loose type of guidance, because it's something that can be changed at pretty much any point. The board can withdraw it or ignore it. And so the public really can't place too much reliance on it. It's just kind of an idea guidance. If the board has rules that are actually unclear, as Melissa was saying, the best thing is to get a rules package through that specifies what the board thinks is going to be best able to inform the public as to what the board's going to be doing.
Yeah, and with regard to the boundary minimum standards, those were questions that came before us numerous times, which is why we impaneled the task force, and they created the new document as a starting point. But we need to get permission to enter into rulemaking to update the standards to reflect any changes that may have happened, and certainly to address comments from the industry and stakeholders about whether they should change, if so, what should change. So really what the task force drafted was a starting point document that we did provide to the governor's office to try to explain and demonstrate what we had hoped to do. We just haven't heard back yet. So
would Jason have been heavily involved in that?
Right. He chaired the task force, which included surveyors from different parts of the state and in different, whether it was private or government practice and that sort of thing. So we had a representative from APLS, which was the big, you know, the surveying association.
Yeah, I've been in contact with APLS. Actually, the day that I found out that I was going to be on the board, they had already contacted me. And I had mentioned to them that I wasn't, I was involved in the original back in late 1990s and start of it. And I talked to the chair. And I asked him, I says, how about coming up with a training tape, you know, for the minimum standards? I says, there you can elaborate, you know, on what you guys would like to do. But I said, you know, it would need approval before we would start issuing it as part of the training for surveyors that come in. You know, instead of a fine or a fine plus this training course or something like that. That was the idea behind it. But APLS is supposed to be working on a training on it that would explain fully what the minimum standards means.
That'll be interesting.
Minimum standards basically is a step-by-step, virtually, start and finish of a survey.
Right. Well, again, it was something the agency considered to try to limit the complaints we got involving boundary surveying and provide more guidance as a regulatory body to the profession and the public. So. But again, I don't know that the agency will get to enter into rulemaking to update them.
My experience is that almost anything you come up with for minimum standards, you'll still have the same problems. I think a lot of it goes to the beginning of the licensing stage. You know, people were not properly supervised or trained, and they will never know.
That's possible. Just deal with it through enforcement.
Yeah, I was going to say rulemaking might be good.
That's what we were hoping.
Yeah. Possibly visiting the rulemaking.
Okay. Any other topics, or are we good with?
Were we going to move forward with that the 666 license number?
Oh.
Is that going to be discussed? Do you guys want to discuss that at a later time?
I think it's a one of, to be honest.
Is that really?
And it would, computer wise, it's going to be really difficult.
Well, we could agendize it for discussion, but we can't really, unfortunately, can't really discuss
issue. Whether we want to agendize it?
We can agendize it.
Like, I don't care. You guys let me know.
Yeah. I'd like to just know if there's, I mean, it is a one-off, but if there's something easy we can do, why not? I mean, if it bugs somebody, like, I'm not sure what the downside is to talk about it.
Okay.
It could be Frax. Yeah, because we're getting into
part of the computer system discussion.
Maybe. All right. Do I have everything else as suggested topics? Record stamping, substantive policy discussion 32144, computer system in the Mills matter. I think those are the four ones that you guys had said
sounds
you wanted.
Good.
Okay.
May 25. And we'll let you know if we get any new members between now and then.
Say that happens, kids. We still come to the meeting and be a member.
It depends on,
because you have a pretty heavy agenda next in May that they won't know squat.
It depends on when we get the notice of appointment and then when the director is able to sign the documentation as to who is legitimately on the board. Between now and the next meeting.
Do you have any ideas of what?
I have no ideas. No ideas. You may be able to stay because I don't know that any geologists have applied.
I know one did.
I thought it didn't matter if it's a public member.
Well, each of the five industries will have one representative, so.
Even if it's trained.
Yes.
Trained, that's right.
Actually, no, it needs to be a registered geologist because we regulate registered geologists. Yeah, so.
But state geologists can be trained.
That's right, and they legally now they can be.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you all.
Thank you.
This is a world record.
I know.
Thank you, everybody.
Good luck, Alejandro.
See you, Alejandro.
Hi, Carmen. Bye, everyone.
Yes, meeting is now adjourned.
Be well, Andy.
I'll second that.
Bye.